Robert Stark and Luke Ford is back. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Robert, how are you?
Great. So I noticed since the last time we talked, I've noticed that you've been focusing more on issues having to do with like ethnicity.
Yes.
I'd say that's been a stronger focus since the last time we talked.
Yes, I run my blog on whatever I'm thinking about at the moment. So as certain issues just, you know, rise up to my cerebral cortex and my prefrontal cortex, and they just pour out of my fingers onto my blog.
So do you have a sort of process of selection, or you just type whatever you think?
I have certain friends that I often bounce things off, and I look to guidance to a handful of friends. And so particularly when I'm dealing with something, radioactive and controversial, like race or anything to do with Jews, then I bounce it off certain friends because I don't want to blow myself up unnecessarily. Things that aren't radioactive and highly controversial, then I feel more free just flinging them out without running them by people I respect.
But I'm actually surprised. So I haven't noticed any media reaction from your articles about race. I haven't seen like a major blog post saying Luke Ford is a white supremacist.
Yeah, I'm.
Is it mostly from your personal friends?
Yeah, you know, I hear people asking if I've turned into a Nazi or things like that. So yeah, I come across these accusations in my personal life, but nobody has taken me on full bore on a journalistic level.
Or you could always try Donald Sterling and say, I'm not racist, I'm Jewish.
Yeah, you know, the hammer's going to fall at
any
time.
Have you tried that?
Well, I don't believe there's any such thing as racism, so I would never plead to not being a racist. I think the whole idea of racism is an absolute blight on our conversation, that if there was such a moral sin as racism, then you would think some of the great moral thinkers in history would have condemned it. But nobody, from Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, to Jesus, to the Bible, both the Hebrew edition and the Greek scriptures, to Augustine, to Aquinas, to Maimonides, to the Quran, to the great Islamic thinkers. Nobody has ever mentioned any such sin as racism. It's an entirely a made-up left-wing notion just developed in the last 100 years.
Have your friends who have given you a hard time, have they been Orthodox or mostly secular people?
Mostly not Orthodox. So the modern Orthodox would have some quibbles with the things I say, but generally speaking, the more rooted you are in a particular identity, the less trouble you will have with the things I say. On the other hand, the more important it is to you to fit in with society's conventions, the more important it is to you to be regarded as cool and to advance in your career and to be regarded among, you know, the proper and right and, you know, the in crowd, then the more trouble you'll have with the things I write on my blog or say in conversation.
Well, our last show we talked about the importance of social status. And this type of writings, like, would you say, does it lower your social status?
Absolutely. It just marks you as a loser. That's just the shorthand. And that's the way the world works right now. If you take unpopular positions, you are regarded as a loser. So if you think that gay marriage is a bad idea, you're regarded as a loser. If you think the whites have as much right to organize in their group interest as any other group, then you're regarded as a loser. If you think that illegal immigration is a bad idea, then you're regarded as a loser. So if you believe that Jews are as worthy of criticism as any other group, then you're regarded as a loser and you're regarded as outside of polite society.
Yeah, I mean, your social status was probably much higher when you were known as the Matt Drudge of Porn.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that, isn't it?
But what I want to say, basically unique about Luke Ford is that you're the only person I can think of who has connections to that kind of fringe politics. But you also have connections to the entertainment culture. I think you're the only individual that you could say that about.
Yeah, I probably have a lot of incongruities built into my story. You know, I've interviewed almost everyone who is important in the pornography industry. I've interviewed hundreds of producers and writers and directors in Hollywood. I know many dozen mainstream journalists, you know, who write for National Review or for the New York Post or for Los Angeles Times or the New Yorker. So, and I'm also immersed in Orthodox Judaism as well as secular fringes of Jewish life, as well as I'm on friendly terms with many white nationalists. So I don't know if there's anyone who has that kind of cross-cultural connections.
Well, I guess I sort of do. I interviewed Dick Smothers. Did you see that one?
No, I really don't read anything about the pornography industry anymore. I really burned out on that a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, I interviewed him on my show, and I don't want to get into this too much, but, I mean, he comments on my Facebook page, and he's definitely a lot more liberal than on these issues than, say, you are, but I would say he's very open-minded. He likes having, like, open discussions.
Yeah, I remember interviewing him, and he was an excellent interview, and that's all I know on that.
Who are some of the big... Who would you say is the biggest... Big at the top celebrities that you've interviewed? Is it just porn or some non-porn celebrities, too?
Oh, gosh. I remember interviewing Tom Landry, the Dallas Cowboys head coach. Larry Bird, the NBA player, you know, a lot of big sports stars. Alan Cranston, who was the senator for California. Haven't interviewed that many celebrity actors. I don't even think about them, so I can't really list off celebrity actors.
You interviewed Rachel Bloom.
Oh, yeah. She's becoming quite big now. I might have been, I think, the first person to do an interview with her, or at least a substantial interview with her. She's an edgy Jewish comic.
To show you how well-known she is, I mean, in my acting class, one of the girls in my acting class was playing one of her songs on our iPhone. I think it was the video. Do you know, have you seen the one she did, the historically accurate of Disney films?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Okay. So I want to, we were touching on this, this ties in with what you were touching on, but I want to announce a major event. So Tom Sunic is coming to LA. He's going to be giving a speech in Beverly Hills. It's going to be, I'll have the correct date posted, but it's going to be September 21st on a Sunday. And Luke Forda, you're going to be giving a speech there as well. And I might give a speech, but I'm not, I'm more of an interviewer than someone who does speeches, but Luke, you're going to be giving a speech.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting Tom Sunic and people who are interested in his ideas.
Do you want to talk about the theme of your speech, or you want to keep it a surprise?
I'm waiting to be asked on what particular topic they want me to speak, so... I don't have anything as yet, so.
And I know Tom is going to be, one of the things he's talking about, he's going to be talking a number of topics. I think one of some of the topics you talk about, I think one of them is like the Islamization of Europe.
Yeah, that's a major theme in his writing, and I think everybody has to ask, is every group equally compatible with United States civilization or first world civilization? And I think it's pretty evidently that not every group is equally compatible with first world European-based civilization. So, for instance, blacks have not assimilated well into any first world society. They've probably done as well in the United States as anywhere, but overall they have not assimilated well. Mestizo Mexicans and Central Americans have not assimilated well into the United States of America. Muslims have assimilated better in the United States than they have in Europe, but still one has to question whether they're a good fit with first world civilization, because there's no country in history of which I'm aware that has become more Muslim, more free. So it seems on the face of things, and I'm not an expert on this, but it seems on the face of things that Muslims and Islam and first world civilization are completely antithetical. And the more you have of one, the less you would think you would have of the other. So I see them as completely at loggerheads, Islam and first world civilization.
Well, there might be some Orthodox Jews that have said that Luke Ford is not totally assimilated into Jewish culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want an easy life, there is no point in converting to Judaism. Judaism is a very intense, competitive civilization, and there is no easy salvation in it. So any convert to Judaism in particular has to walk a difficult road, not just into his conversion, but out of his conversion and going forward in Jewish life. So the thing about belonging to a tribe is there are a lot of restrictions, and there's tremendous pressure to conform to group norms. And unless you conform to group norms, you tend to get either pushed to the margins or expelled. So that's the dynamic in every tribal group, including in Orthodox Judaism.
What are some particular areas, like cultural or also having to do with your own personality, that have caused you to struggle to fit in with that culture?
Well, I think the fundamental problem is just a temperamental quirk that I share with my father, in that we both have this drive to show that we're the smartest people in the group, and that we really should be the ones running things. And of course, that never works in a group. So 99% of the time, this quirk of mine has not worked out well for me. I think 1% of the time when I got to run my high school and college newspapers, and I think I did a good job. And there may be a few other things that I've run over the course of my life where I did do a good job. But generally speaking, this personality quirk of wanting to show oneself off to be really smart and to be the one in charge is going to polarize and alienate, you know, people. So it's primarily a psychological illness, call it narcissism, which has
maybe
hurt me.
I think that could be one of the reasons you're interested in like white advocacy, because white advocacy is probably be much easier to become a leader in that movement than it would be to become a leader of say like the Jewish community in LA. You think that's a factor?
Who knows? I'm sure everything I do is shot filled with my own psychological makeup. So I know there is like a real attention-seeking drive in me, which comes from growing up in foster care, and where I had to really, you know, raise holy hell to get any attention whatsoever at times. So when I was an infant, this trait of mine, you know, might have saved my life, but it hasn't been well adapted to my adult life. So you know, that's one reason why I'm in psychotherapy, because I know that I have many self-destructive psychological traits, and it's another reason why I've embraced 12-step work for various emotional addictions that I struggle with.
And speaking about addiction, I know you commented on Robin Williams, and you even said with Robin Williams, he suffered from addiction, but you also noticed traits of eroticized rage.
Okay, so I don't remember saying anything about Robin Williams struggling with eroticized rage, but I think I did note that a lot of Hollywood celebrities have lost their lives to addictions, be it Robin Williams or Philip Seymour Hoffman or the director Tony Scott, who committed suicide. So addiction is a progressive and deadly disease, and unless people, you know, get a handle on it, it can kill them.
And what do you see as some of the, can you identify a root cause of addiction? Would you say some of it is caused by a lack of attachment or insecurity?
Yeah, I think the root cause of addiction is feeling miserable inside because you do not attach normally to other people. And so you seek out ways to get rid of that horrible feeling. And so for some people, it's drugs. For other people, it's alcohol. For other people, it's food. For others, it's spending. For others, it's sex or pornography or attention seeking or just numbing out to television. For instance, if you eat a big bowl of food, if you really eat a big meal, that will reduce your anxiety levels because all the blood will rush to your stomach to try to digest the meal, and you will feel less anxious. So an addict is typically walking around feeling very anxious and looking for external fixes for that anxiety.
And also, you posted a book a while back about paranoia, and you say paranoia is caused by it's caused by insecurity, as opposed to most people say paranoia is caused by schizophrenia. Do you remember when you posted that?
Yeah,
book review from the New York Times.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by all the results of lack of attachment, is lack of normal human attachment, is something that has troubled me over the course of my life. And so paranoia is just one example. When people become paranoid, it's usually because they don't have enough attachments to people that they can confide in. And so their dark thoughts, they have no one that they can bounce them off of. And in this unattached state, people tend to spiral downhill, and they can spiral into addiction, or they can spiral into paranoia, or they can spiral into antisocial behavior to try to get attention for themselves, or they can act out their rage against women like the Santa Barbara killer a few months ago.
Oh, that's where I heard. I think Yoshi left a comment because Yoshi said that he visited Santa Barbara recently.
Yeah, and when I read the writings of the Santa Barbara killer, they were very powerful writings. He wrote well, and I think many frustrated, lonely guys would identify with his rage that you're seeing people all around you having sex, and you don't get any, and so you're going to feel like a complete loser. So in a traditional society, these sexual differences are kind of muted and played down because it's not considered proper to have a lot of sex partners or to dress in a very provocative way or to boast about your sex life or to conduct it in a very open way. So therefore, that kind of reduces the boiling temperature of erotic desire in a society. And without that, the tremendous differences that nature bestows on us in terms of our ability to attract a mate, in terms of, you know, our beauty, our strength, our charm, our social skills, these differences in a modern society become much more magnified. So the sexual playing field becomes much more brutal and in your face. And so it was against this that I think the Santa Barbara killer was reacting.
And I guess, would you say, like, in Orthodox Judaism, do they promote sexual modesty, like, in the way they dress?
Yeah, it's not considered proper in Orthodox Judaism to be immodest, and modesty is not just something that governs the way you dress, but it governs the way you conduct your life. So attention seeking is not considered modest. Thrusting yourself out to be the leader is not considered modest. You know, whoring after publicity is not considered modest. Certainly having a promiscuous sex life is not considered proper, and talking about having a promiscuous sex life is really considered gauche. So in traditional societies, not just Orthodox Judaism, sexuality is tamped down, and it's something that's, generally speaking, kept much more muted and quiet, so that these tremendous disparities, which naturally exist in a modern society or in an unconstructed society, don't tear people apart like they are in America today.
Yeah, and I mean, what Yoshi visited there, but that place, Isla Vista, is probably one of the most sort of hyper-sexualized environments that out of anywhere you can go. I mean, the porn industry, yeah, but the porn industry is like behind scenes in a studio in Chatsworth, so you're not going to see it. But it's mostly out in the open.
Yeah, it's brutal when you go to a university and it's filled with the beautiful people who appear to be having a lot of sex and enjoying a great life. Well, let's say you have some social skill problems, you have problems reading social cues, let's say you're just not particularly attractive, you are not an outgoing personality. If you're painfully shy, you're not going to be sleeping with a lot of women. If you, struggle with acne, you're probably not going to be sleeping with a lot of women. So seeing all the beautiful people, partying and leading an idyllic life can really eat you up inside. Yes, and I say this, of course, as someone who's frequently been a loser. So I know what that's like. I remember once in high school. Yeah, let me just tell you the story. I remember in high school, my family had moved out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and so we were kind of in the secular world, and I was going to a secular school for the first time in my life. And I remember one Sabbath afternoon, I'd just gone for a walk, and I walked by the football field at my school, and off in the distance, I saw some acquaintances of mine, and they were kind of gathering around this big table, and so I started to walk towards them, and then I saw that they were having some big party, and I realized I wasn't invited, so I just, I suddenly stopped, turned around, and walked home, and it was just, it was very painful seeing the beautiful popular crowd having such a great time and realizing that I was not invited. I had a therapist who suggested that I call my memoir The Uninvited.
Oh, yeah, huh. You decided to make it eroticized rage.
Yeah, but I thought she had an interest.
And I like your... And I guess I'll comment on some interesting parts of that play. I think the first line was really funny, as you were saying you're going to stay with your future wife until she graduates high school and you can finish your memoir on eroticized rage.
Yeah, it's interesting how
and
much.
And then you.
It's interesting how much hatred you get if you mention, I'm a 48-year-old man, but you still find attractive what you found attractive as a teenager. So it's not politically correct. But if you, first begin noticing girls in an erotic, romantic way, which, for me was from, age 10, 11, 12, 13. So, yeah, like even a 16-year-old girl can still be very attractive to me. I would never break the law and I would not date an underage girl. But that's the way men are made. Any man who says that he doesn't find 16-year-old girls attractive is a liar.
Except when the waves crash you into them by mistake.
Yeah, I was the victim there. Yeah, you're
And
talking.
I guess the other.
Talking about
Yeah,
when I
your
was
trip
in
to
Australia,
Australia.
yeah, where I got caught in a riptide and it just kept dragging me into this group of teenage girls who were learning how to surf. So I got out of the ocean, I went back to swimming, and once again, the tide just pulled me right into these teenage girls.
And I guess some other highlights of I like your one where you go Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai and Luke Ford gets his Thorazine at Cedar Sinai.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean I was actually born there.
Oh, really? Were you circumcised at birth?
No, actually, was not. Oh, and the other interesting thing about it is another interesting thing you said in your play Eroticized Rage was I know because you've been writing a lot about the conflict in Gaza and Israel, but you had a piece where you said that you understand like the perspective of Palestinians who become suicide bombers in that play.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I think the perspective of the suicide bomber is familiar to anyone who's been socially ostracized and would do anything to become cool. So the suicide bombers are really the best and the brightest of Palestinian society. They're usually the dregs or the ones who are most disposable. And one of the ways they are induced to become suicide bombers is by telling them that they'll become cool, that they will be revered by their people, and their name will go down through the generations and their family will be honored. And so for someone who is ostracized and has felt uncool most of his life, that's a very appealing pitch, and I totally understand it.
And would you say that radical Islam, do they utilize eroticized rage?
Wow, I'm sure they tap into rage as perhaps their primary motivator, because as Tom Wolfe pointed out in the 2006 lecture, every group needs to see itself as the center of the world, as the very best. And so how do Muslims and Arabs see themselves as the best? Because almost in no conceivable category are they leading the way and showing us a better way. Like blacks, for instance, they have so many black stars in pop culture and so many black athletes, and they have a black president in the United States. You know, they have a lot of things that they can see themselves in as the best, but Muslims and Arabs have nothing. And so that must breed tremendous anger and shame and rage, because as long as Israel exists, it's this beacon of civilization, of first world living in their third world, you know, cesspool. So just the very existence of a Jewish state, if they just left the Jewish state in peace, the Jewish state would so far excel them that it would be absolutely unbearable. So it's easier for Arabs and the Palestinians and the Muslims to believe lies and crazy conspiracy theories, anything to face the shame of their own failure.
Would you say there's parallels between that and some of the minority groups in the United States?
Yeah, you see a high rate of belief of conspiracy theories among blacks, say much higher than you'd find among, say, Orientals or Ashkenazi Jews, for instance, who kind of are on the very opposite end of the socioeconomic status from blacks. So blacks who are struggling and see other blacks overwhelmingly staying at the lowest end of the socioeconomic ladder need to believe in some theory that justifies why their people is failing. And so it's much easier to believe in conspiracy theories than it is to face the truth that blacks have simply not evolved, generally speaking, to compete at a high level in a first world society.
I know people like to say that white nationalist types are into conspiracy theories. Do you see that?
Maybe there are, but No, I don't. I think it's more of a surface thing. There are many levels of white nationalism, and so among the smart ones, no, you don't see this. But white nationalism is also pitched to people with 100 IQs. So just imagine what it's like to go through life with a 90, 95, or a 100 IQ. You know that you're constantly dealing with people who are smarter than you. So there is a very primitive and low IQ part of white nationalism that is peddled for the low IQ crowd, but often it's done as a metaphor. For instance, let's take Holocaust denial. Now, the people who are leading, Holocaust deniers, for instance, never regard themselves as Holocaust deniers. That's a pejorative that their critics put on them. What they're really attacking is the Jewish moral superiority that comes with being this enormous victim, that non-Jews have to treat Jews with extra care and sensitivity because Jews suffered in the Holocaust. That's what the so-called Holocaust deniers are really attacking. It really has nothing to do with how many Jews died in Auschwitz. What it has to do with is denying that Jews
Yeah, I
should
mean,
be
even
treated differently from non-Jews.
Greg Johnson is he's a white nationalist, and he's been described as, I would say, he's fairly anti-Jewish, but he basically says the same thing that you just said.
Yeah, so on the surface, it seems that the so-called Holocaust deniers are believers in conspiracy theories, but really on a sophisticated level, that they're leading intellectuals. It's nothing to do with the number of Jews who died in gas chambers at Auschwitz, and it's all about undercutting Jewish claims that because of the Holocaust, therefore XYZ. See, intellectual life is dominated by Jews, and much of the thinking that is prohibited to talk about in intellectual life in the West and in particular in America is because it could lead to A, which could lead to B, which could lead to C, which could then lead to genocide. So, for instance, it's forbidden to talk about IQ differences among various groups because that could supposedly lead to genocide or a Holocaust. And so Jewish sensitivity to the Holocaust has led for Jews to push for all sorts of things politically and culturally, which many whites understandably regard as not good for them. And perhaps the leading exponent of the white protest against Jewish influence shaping First World countries in a way that is negative for white people would be Kevin MacDonald, whose books, Jews and non-Jews should study and argue with.
Yeah, so and Kevin MacDonald tries to, he doesn't really get it. He tries to stay clear of like Holocaust revisionism.
Well, it's just not his area. So, and again, Holocaust revisionism really has. It's only ostensibly about the Holocaust. What it's really about is protesting Jewish influence that uses things like the Holocaust to shape society in a certain direction that many Jewish elites regard as better for the Jews.
And what is your so what is your advice to those to people in, say, white advocacy who want to tackle those issues? What would be your advice to them?
I don't really see myself in the advice-giving game. I see myself more in the game of just trying to understand the world around.
Are you back?
Yeah, I'm here. So, what was your last question? Oh, you asked me what advice I give to people who are trying to package white nationalism. And my point is, I don't give advice. That's more in the realm of public relations, which is not something that I promote, generally speaking. Generally speaking, publicists are paid liars. So my interest is in understanding the world around me more than it is in how to package a particular point of view so that it's more successful.
And that's basically, I would describe myself the same way. I'm more interest I mean I'm not like I don't describe I said this the last time, I don't describe myself as a political advocate. I'm more into trying to analyze society and how the world works.
Yeah, like if you're going to really get strongly into advocacy, generally speaking, your analysis will suffer.
Yeah, because you basically become a politician, and once you're a politician, you lose that brutal honesty.
Yeah, because, you know, if you're primarily looking for truth, then you're constantly going to see things that challenge your point of view or that are inconvenient for your point of view, and you'll try to play them down so as to promote your ideas. And that's not what I'm about. I'm more about interested in seeing the whole picture.
And one of your recent posts, you have a post called "Is it anti-Semitic to say Jews are good with money?" So this the context is you had a girlfriend a while back. Did she complain about something you said?
Well, I just asked her if she's ever experienced anti-Semitism, because I have never experienced anti-Semitism. But then again, I'm not someone who's easily offended. In fact, I don't think I've ever been offended in my life. So she said that she constantly experienced anti-Semitism just all the time. So I asked her for an example, and she said, well, you know, I had this boss, and she said to me, well, you people are good with money. And to my girlfriend, that was an anti-Semitic statement. To me, it was a compliment towards Jews. Like, how could being good with money be a bad thing? But, you know, if you're hypersensitive, or if you see that you can score social points by intimidating people and by being ultra-sensitive to any perceived slight, or if you see that anyone saying that your group is good in one thing, that they then might say that your group is bad in something else. You know, this is a hypersensitive and manipulative, very popular way of thinking, and it seems to be the way that's dominant in our country, but I absolutely despise it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the word racism in today's society basically means criticism.
Yeah, or it's just any comment about a group that I don't like, you know, I'm just going to call it racist, because being a racist is basically the worst thing you can be in polite society today.
And you had another video, I think it's one of your latest videos, on more on your search for an Orthodox wife. And you were saying you were dating this girl from Brazil. I mean, I don't know if she was Orthodox or not, but she was offended by your blog.
Oh, give me some more details. I don't remember what I said. I mean, people are always, oh, yeah,
this
yeah.
Fairly,
no, yeah,
fairly,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's yeah, fairly
yeah.
recent.
Yeah, I do remember now. And, yeah, she promised me all sorts of rewards if I'd simply stop posting about IQ differences among different races. And, you know, I prefer to post about IQ differences among different races than to get together with her. I don't want to get together with someone at the cost of my intellectual freedom. But, you know, women are much more conformist than guys are. They're much more sensitive to anything that's uncool, anything that could reduce their connections and social status. Men are much more nonconformist and adventurous.
So she gave you an ultimatum, either her or your blog.
Yeah. And I chose my blog.
So would you take that stance unconditionally, or are there some women out there you give up your blog for?
There may be women out there that I'd give up my blog for.
But she wasn't one of them.
No.
And you commented, on that show on Showtime, The Masters of Sex.
I don't remember what I said. You'll have to prompt me.
Oh, you know, Masters of Sex is a show about it's based on a true story. It's where there's this doctor who's analyzing sex, and the doctor on that show analyzed different races.
Oh yeah, so
sexual characteristics,
yeah,
and that's
now I
show on
remember.
Showtime.
Yeah, now I remember. So in the last episode, or maybe the episode before, the doctor was trying to get this black newspaper to not run an article, and so he threatened them that if they ran the article, he'd have to reveal significant differences between blacks and non-blacks in sexual behavior. And I think common sense suggests, all the differences that he outlined that he might have to reveal. In the show, it portrays him as just making them up, but in reality, they were all true. Blacks do tend to have higher testosterone levels than whites. They do tend to have larger sexual organs. They do tend to have larger secondary sexual characteristics. They do tend to have less stable family life. They do tend to have lower IQs. They do tend to have higher rates of STDs. They do tend to commit higher rates of crime, including violent crime. So all the things that the show portrays him
So
as
does
just
the
making
show
up.
explicitly say that?
Well, the show portrays it that he's threatening to make up these statistics
Does the
to.
show How explicit does the show actually get about that?
No more than just what I said. It's a drama, so it's not a documentary, and it's simply that's just simply one scene.
And you had a post about the city of Los Angeles, why Los Angeles is falling apart. And I mean, I'm from Los Angeles as well, so this interests me. But I mean, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in LA since? First of all, how long have you lived in LA?
I've lived in Los Angeles since 1994, but I was here for a year in 1988 to 89. And I read books, I read history, so I know that California was once a working man's paradise, that housing was no more expensive in California than anywhere else, that ordinary working men and women could come here, get a job, buy a home, and send their children to excellent public schools, and there were low rates of crime. But that was when California was dominantly a white state. Now, increasingly, it's a Latino state, largely populated by either illegal aliens or the descendants of illegal aliens. And most of these people came here because they couldn't make it in Mexico. So they couldn't graduate school in Mexico. They couldn't lead a decent life in Mexico. So they came to the United States. And so they continue on in California, in particular, the very low rate of achievement that they had in Mexico. But the main point is the races don't assimilate. So Korean Americans behave like Koreans, even if they've been in America for four generations. And Swedish Americans behave like Swedes, even if they've been in America for six generations. And African Americans behave very similarly to Africans, as long as they're genetically dominantly from Africa. So, when African Americans mate with white Americans, then you get mulattoes who tend to have a combination of white and black traits.
And can you talk about the area where you live, what that's like? Is it I know what's interesting is where you are in the Pico Robertson area. If you go a little bit south of there, you get or a little bit to the east, you get into areas that are kind of ghetto. Do you notice
Yeah,
that?
so on Pico Boulevard, if you go five blocks south of Pico Boulevard, you move into a black area, and there are a lot of gangbangers there. And so all the people that I hear about who are committing violent crimes and armed robberies in my neighborhood, they're always young black men. And people I know were held up at gunpoint on La Cienega Boulevard and Olympic Boulevard on Friday night a couple of weeks ago. This is Beverly Hills. So the young black gangbangers come into Pico Robertson and Beverly Hills and commit massive amounts of crime. And it's not Orthodox Jews that are committing these armed robberies. And it's generally speaking not even Latinos. And it's certainly not Orientals. It's young black men. So young black men commit murder, for instance, at a rate 27 times out of any other group. And blacks in general commit murder at a rate at least 7 times higher than non-blacks.
Do Orthodox Jews, do they talk about that? Do they talk about that issue openly?
Yeah, the more traditional the Orthodox Jew the less they're concerned about fitting in with wider society, and therefore the more openly they can discuss matters of race and reality and the racial aspect of crime. So the more the Jew's trying to fit in with conventional modern society, the more reticent he is to be honest and blunt about these things.
And I guess onto a different topic, I noticed you wrote about Israeli ambiguity applied to organ transplants. Was this about that case in Costa Rica?
Yeah, so it was a very interesting article in the New York Times by about this group of Israeli entrepreneurs in the organ transplant business. And so they would pay people to donate a kidney and then sell it to, say, someone in Israel. And that was a business for them. And it just reminded me how Jews have often done society's dirty work. So for a conventional goy, this would not be an appropriate way to make a living. But Jews were, for instance, in medieval times, were moneylenders when Christians thought of that work as dirty. Jews have been in the pornography industry and the rap industry when many non-Jews would regard those industries as dirty. Same goes for Hollywood, and same goes for organ transplants, where as a capitalist, I think people absolutely should have the right to sell their body organs and to buy body organs.
Do you personally consider that morally wrong?
I think it's no. I think buying and selling body organs is.
Yeah, we got cut off again, but the audio should work on your end.
Yeah, so you're asking me, do I consider it morally wrong to buy and sell body organs? And no, I do not consider it morally wrong so long as everyone's consenting. See, nothing wrong with it. I think it should be left to the free market.
And your view, would you say that's your view sort of about porn is fairly, would you say your views about social issues are fairly libertarian, like abortion and gay marriage?
No, I'd say they're more traditional rather than libertarian. So I'm definitely opposed to gay marriage. I think it's an abomination. I think it destroys society. It's terribly cruel to children to have them be raised by same-sex couples when they could have been adopted by opposite-sex couples. Abortion, generally speaking, it's probably morally wrong to have an abortion for convenience, but if the babies that are being aborted, which seems to be correct, are overwhelmingly unwanted babies from parents of inferior genetic stock, then it's probably a good thing overall for society. I think we need to have a licensing system that before people can have children, they have to get a license. They have to demonstrate that they have superior intelligence, that they have stayed out of trouble, that they've never been on welfare or disability or on food stamps, that they're high achieving academically and professionally. Only then should they be allowed to have kids. Now, we can't have three generations of imbeciles. Like, I think three generations of imbeciles is too many. I don't think we need generation after generation of people on welfare. I don't think they should be allowed to reproduce. So I think the best solution is to give every girl Norplant starting at about age 11 and renew it every 5 years. And only if she has demonstrated that she's a responsible adult should she be allowed to have children.
Well, what if someone says that you shouldn't have kids because of all your past like issues of addiction and the narcissistic personality disorder? What if someone decides that?
I don't really care what people say. I wouldn't prohibit people from having kids because they're narcissistic. I'd prohibit them from having kids if they have a felony. I've never had a felony conviction. I prohibit people from having kids if they're on disability. I am not on disability. I would prohibit people from having kids if they're on welfare. I'm not on welfare. I prohibit people from having kids if they're on food stamps. I'm not on food stamps. I prohibit people from having kids if they had an IQ under 100. Now, my IQ is, north of 115. So I think I'm pretty consistent.
Wait, what percentage of the population has an IQ under 100? That's probably the majority of like the population of LA.
Yeah, it's probably be 50% of the population. So I'd be quite happy if the lower 50% of our population in terms of IQ did not reproduce. If they want to reproduce, fine, let them leave the United States and not come back.
And you're probably gonna get, would you get people like comparing you to like Hitler with those views?
Certainly, but actually Hitler didn't really do much with eugenics. Eugenics was much more popular in the United States and in England and the Scandinavian countries than it was in Hitler's Germany. So it would just show that these people are ignorant.
Was he interested in IQ? I heard he was actually less interested in IQ test than
Hitler and the
Anglosphere was.
Nazis banned IQ tests because Jews did so much better than Germans. So both Hitler and Stalin banned IQ tests.
Oh, Stalin did too.
Yes.
And I got this post from a while back where you wrote, it's called Oh Yeah, Jewish Women Are Hot, and you talk about. Oh, you talk about different movies you saw. Was this a reference? It was a reference to a number of movies, but oh, there was a study about fetishes. That was a context from Details Magazine.
Well, yeah, like many men do fetishize Jewish women because Jewish women are, on average, highly accomplished. So, some men fetishize about the type of women who clean toilets for a living. Now, other men fetishize about attractive women who are doctors, lawyers, professors, CEOs, executives, run networks and studios. So, someone who fetishizes Jewish women, fetishizes intelligence and accomplishment, and type of person usually has a lot of energy and drive and is highly accomplished and is well read. So, I think that's a beautiful thing to fetishize the accomplished, the intelligent, and people who are making a difference in the world.
Is that, would you say that was a factor why you converted?
No, I didn't really know any Jewish women when I was thinking and deciding to convert to Judaism, so I didn't even think about it.
So you didn't necessarily, did you have a like, that wasn't your preference as far as dating? That wasn't a factor?
I'd never met any Jewish women by the time I was first introduced to Judaism when I was at UCLA, and I think my whole first year at UCLA, I don't recall meeting any Jewish women. So, but what I did meet was various professors who were Orthodox Jews. I listened to Dennis Prager on the radio, who's a religious, they're not Orthodox Jew. And so it was intellectually that Judaism got me excited, but it was some years after that before I started meeting Jewish women.
And oh yeah, you said it was actually listed. Was it the second most rated hit for porn sites?
I guess, but you're referring to a blog post from like 4 years ago. I don't, really remember many details.
Oh yeah, and you mentioned the movie The Black Swan.
Yeah, this is from 4 years ago. So, there are a type of men who fetishize checkout girls at Ralph's, and there are a type of men who fetishize girls who are janitors, and there are a type of men like me who fetishize highly accomplished, very smart women who, dress sexy and are whip smart and read books and also look good.
Are most of the men who have a fetish for intelligent, would you say they're highly intelligent themselves?
Yeah, I can't imagine that low intelligent or middling intelligent men are not going to fetishize highly intelligent women because it would just be too emasculating. Like, no man likes to think, that the object of his desire is far smarter than he is. And I think in general, I agree with, Richard Lynn, just from my empirical experiences that in general, men are about 5 IQ points higher than women. So women are usually more conformist and they're usually the nicer, more better behaved students, but the really good students at a university are overwhelmingly men. Like the smartest ones. Best behaved are the girls, but the smartest students who are going to make the biggest impact on the world are invariably men.
Yeah, it seems if men are overrepresented at the very top and the very bottom.
Yeah, but still, I'd say that the bell curve shifts to the right by 5 points for men. This is what Richard Lynn concluded as well. Men have much bigger brains than women do, even accounting for body size.
Would you say most of the women you've dated have been highly intelligent, or you've dated some dumb women as well?
No, all the women I've dated have been highly intelligent. Even the porn stars were women who enjoyed reading books. I've never gone to bed with any woman who did not read books for fun.
And what are your thoughts on what types of men like really stupid women?
Oh gosh. Well, I think it's natural. Most men do not like to compete, you know, with their woman as far as intellectual and professional accomplishments. So I think that's natural. Like, very few men like a ball buster. Like the women in. So there is something erotic about a woman who's not trying to compete with you and is not trying to prove how smart she is. So. The women in porn, you know, the sex objects are rarely put themselves out as super smart, even when sometimes they are, because they know that generally speaking, men aren't looking for intelligence in their sex objects.
And in the interview you did with Yoshi, you mentioned one thing is you think over a long term having a lot of having a lot of sex partners can be unhealthy for, you said for women especially, but for men it can cause them to be calloused.
Yeah, like I can see a difference in women. Usually it's much more dramatic. The more sex partners they have, you can see it taking a toll on them psychologically and with their appearance. Usually it kind of wears them out, and they hit the wall much, much quicker. With men, they develop a cynicism and an easy capacity to exploit and use people and abuse people that comes with seducing a lot of women. So the effect on men is more subtle. But yeah, from what I've seen of women who've slept around, it usually does not evidence itself in a positive way in either their looks or their demeanor or their happiness level. I think it's overwhelmingly true that the ideal number of sexual partners for happiness is one. And once you start going beyond that, people are increasingly less happy and less stable.
So we're out of time, but I want to make an announcement. So Luke Ford and I are going to be at the Tom Sunic event, so I will be interviewing Tom Sunic later on this week, and we'll be announcing the details. So, Luke, I look forward to meeting you for the first time in person.
Yeah, sounds good. Look forward to it, Robert.
Thanks again, Luke, for being on. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.